The series as a whole, of course, as you've heard, is concerned with the transformation of life and world in the Sutra of Golden Light. And as I mentioned last week, transformation of life, of individual life, of self, is represented by chapter 3 of the Sutra, that is to say, the chapter of confession. And transformation of world is represented by the chapters in which various gods and goddesses come forward and promise to protect the Sutra. In tonight's lecture, as well as in next week's lecture, we're concerned with the first of these. We're concerned with transformation of life, transformation of self, and concerned, therefore, mainly with chapter 3 of the Sutra. And at the beginning of this chapter, we find the Bodhisattva Ruchiraketu falling asleep. And while he is asleep, he has a wonderful dream. It's not an ordinary dream, it's what the American Indians call a big dream, a dream of vast archetypal significance. In fact, the dream is a spiritual experience, even a transcendental experience. But why should this Bodhisattva, why should the Bodhisattva Ruchiraketu have this dream? Why should he have this experience? Now, in order to understand this, we have to go back to the previous chapter of the Sutra. And it's at the beginning of this previous chapter that we meet Ruchiraketu for the first time. His name, by the way, means beautiful comet, or even beautiful streamer. And Ruchiraketu, the Bodhisattva, lives in the great city of Rajagriha, which in the Buddha's day was the capital of the kingdom of Magadha. And Ruchiraketu lived there at the time of, in the day of the Buddha. And he was a follower of the great way, that is to say, a follower of the Mahayana. Not only a follower of the Mahayana, the great way, he was in fact a Bodhisattva. That is to say, he had dedicated himself to the attainment of supreme enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And according to the sutra, Ruchiraketu is quite an advanced bodhisattva. I don't know if you know very much about bodhisattvas or about the difference between bodhisattvas who are advanced and bodhisattvas who are not advanced, etc. But Ruchiraketu apparently was quite an advanced bodhisattva. For instance, the sutra tells us that in previous lives he'd rendered great service to a previous Buddha, that he planted roots of merit, that is to say, he performed innumerable skillful actions, and he is in fact highly respected, even revered, by hundreds of thousands of millions of Buddhas. You notice the Mahayana sutras going for these very, very large figures indeed. Nevertheless, though Ruchiraketu is a bodhisattva, though he is even an advanced bodhisattva, though he is revered by all these Buddhas, Ruchiraketu has a problem. It's not a personal problem. It's not a psychological problem. It's a problem about the Buddha. He can't understand why the Buddha should have such a short life. Only 80 years. Now, we probably would not find this a problem. We'd think it only natural that the Buddha should not live for more than 80 years. If the Buddha lived longer than that, we might think that's a bit of a problem. But not so Ruchiraketu. For Ruchiraketu, the fact that the Buddha lives only 80 years is a problem. And he reasons like this. He says, or he reflects, that the Buddha, in his teaching, in his discourses, has said that there are certain causes why one has a long life, just as there are certain causes why one has a short life. In fact, the Buddha has said, so Ruchiraketu reflects, so he remembers, that there are two main causes for long life. Two courses of action which, if you follow, you will ensure for yourself in future existences long life. So what are those two causes? What are those two courses of action? First of all, that you refrain from killing living beings. That's, of course, the first precept. And secondly, that you give away food. You give away incredible quantities of food if you want to live long in your future life. So these two things. You must refrain from killing living beings, and you must give away food, even if it's only tea and biscuits after the lecture. Now, the Buddha himself, Rūśara Kētu, knows, has refrained from killing living beings for innumerable lifetimes. The text, in fact, says, for many incalculable hundreds of thousands of millions of aeons, which is clear enough. And the Buddha, in all those previous existences, has also adhered to the 10 skillful actions. And not only that, he's actually given food to living beings. Not only given them food, he's given them all sorts of internal and external objects of enjoyment, nutriment, pleasure. He's even gone so far, in some of his previous existences, the Buddha has even gone so far as to sacrifice his own flesh, his own blood, his own bones and marrow, in order to feed other living beings, as when, according to the famous Jataka story, he fed the starving tigress and her cubs with his own flesh and blood. So the Buddha has done all these things, Rūśara Kētu knows. And if the law of karma is true, if the Buddha is to reap under the law of karma the results of all his actions, of his refraining from taking life, of giving an abundance of food, of sacrificing his own flesh and blood to others for food, then the Buddha should surely have an immeasurable length of life. He should live at least for a few million years. But no, the Buddha's measure of life is only a miserable 80 years. So Rūśara Kētu has a problem. And he's very worried, as people usually are when they have a problem, very concerned and very perplexed. Now, as I've said, Rūśara Kētu's problem is probably not our problem. We probably wouldn't be bothered by that particular problem. We don't have that sort of faith. But we do have problems. Problems of our own. Problems even of our very own. One could even go so far as to say that there is no spiritual life without problems. Problems are a means of development, even a means of transformation. Now, when I say problems, I mean problems. By problems, I don't mean simply difficulties, little passing difficulties that look so big and so important at the moment. Difficulties can be met simply by using our intelligence, by making a greater effort. That's how you meet, that's how you settle, that's how you sort out difficulties. But problems, real problems, problems which are deeply and genuinely problems, these have to be solved in quite another way, as we shall see. A problem, as distinct from a difficulty, is something that cannot be solved on its own terms. Yet, the terms cannot be changed. Strictly speaking, a real problem cannot be solved at all. That's the beauty of it. At the same time, it must be solved. And we see this quite clearly in the case of Rūśara Kētu. He believes that under the law of karma, the performance of certain skillful actions will result in long life. And he believes that the Buddha has performed those actions, performed them to an immeasurable extent. But at the same time, he sees that the Buddha does have a very short life, only 80 years. So it's not possible for Rūśara Kētu to change the terms of the problem. He cannot doubt the law of karma. He cannot doubt that the Buddha has performed the appropriate skillful actions for innumerable lifetimes. But he cannot deny also that the Buddha's life is short. So the situation in which Rūśara Kētu finds himself is one logically absurd and two, psychologically and spiritually, intensely unsatisfactory, uncomfortable, painful and distressing. In other words, the sort of situation he finds himself in is of the type reflected in the Zen koan. And koans, as we all know, cannot be solved. If you clap your hands together, you produce a sound. But what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's a koan. Or you come into the master's room for an interview perhaps, or maybe for some other purpose, but you're not carrying anything, your hands are quite empty. And the master asks, "What are you carrying?" And you reply, "Nothing." And the master says, "Well, put it down then." And if you don't comply immediately, you apparently get 30 blows. Perhaps the most famous of all koans, at least in the West, is the goose and the bottle. There is a goose, we are told, in a bottle. We're never told how it got there, of course. The goose is fully grown. The neck of the bottle is very narrow. And the problem is that you have to get the goose out of the bottle without damaging the bird and without breaking the bottle. In other words, you can't change the terms of the problem. And in Zen monasteries, students sweat for years over these problems, over these koans.